Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of food, health, and the environment. And each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your personal well-being and what's going on in our communities, our society, and the global systems and infrastructures that influence the ecological balance of our habitat, planet Earth. Each week on the show, we talk with different advocates, experts, analysts, authors, scientists, policymakers, thought leaders, filmmakers, all kinds of different people about the different facets of what's going on in our world that has impact short-term, medium-term, and long-term on the health and well-being of living beings here on planet Earth. On today's show, we return to a topic in a new form that we've covered many, many times on this program, beginning in about 2014. And our guest today is someone who has been one of the most frequent guests on, recurring guests on Connect the Dots, and you'll soon learn why. I'm delighted to welcome back William Warren, Senior Trade Analyst at Friends of the Earth. Bill works to protect the environment from the negative impact of international trade and investment agreements. So, you know, TPP and beyond is what we're talking about today. Bill contributes to the policy discussion about trade and environmental issues as they arise in community forums, the U.S. congressional debate, the federal agency process, international negotiations, and litigation before international trade and investment tribunals. Bill is an attorney, and he has served as the Federal Affairs Counsel for the National Conference of State Legislatures, and is originally from the state of Illinois and a graduate of the University of Illinois and Duke Law School. And Bill is here today to update us on the status of where we are with the kinds of global trade agreements that, you know, large corporations in alliance with the executive levels of government have been trying to enact. And have successfully enacted in certain instances, and we'll be talking about that and the history of that. Regular listeners of the show are aware that from about 2014-2015 up until and throughout all of 2016, thanks to Bill and other advocates and experts on this topic, on Connect the Dots, we did a lot of ongoing reporting to raise awareness about the trade agreements, TPP and beyond. And probably at this point, a lot of people, thanks to Bill's excellent work and the work of other allies, as well as my contribution and that of other journalists, a lot more people are aware of these agreements and their high-risk impacts than was so when all of this began back in 2014 and even earlier. Thankfully, the Obama administration's attempt to pass these trade agreements last December in the lame duck session of Congress failed. However, that doesn't mean that, you know, we're home free and the problem has gone away. On today's show, we'll be talking about the stance of the Trump administration as well as what their proposed revision of NAFTA, the North Atlantic Free Trade Agreement, means for the issues that we cover in this regard. So welcome back to Connect the Dots to educate us to the current situation, Bill Warren.
Well, thank you, Allison. It's always a pleasure and an honor.
So, you know, back when the president and his legislative supporters in the Senate and Congress found that they did not have the votes necessary to pass the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, in the lame duck session of Congress in 2016. All of us here concerned about the far-reaching impacts of those kinds of trade agreements heaved a big sigh of relief, even though we knew that the respite was temporary. Listeners, you know, you can go back into the Connected Dot archives and Google the shows with Bill Warren, as well as with Kevin Zeese and Margaret Flowers and Dan Sorcher and other people who've regularly spoken on these agreements to sort of get up. But just for a capsule introduction for those newly listening now, Bill, what is the core problem with these global trade agreements?
Well, the core problem is that they're, in many respects, trade agreements in name only. I mean, they do deal with imports and exports of goods and services, but ever since the North American Free Trade Agreement and the WTO World Trade Organization Agreement were put in place well over 20 years ago, these quote-unquote trade agreements really sweep much more broadly. And basically what they do is they mandate the rollback of public interest regulations and public interest policies that have been established by democratic parliamentary institutions and democratically elected governments. And unlike other international deals, these so-called trade deals can be effectively enforced through a system of quote-unquote arbitration, really in effect an international court that can trump the decisions of Congress, the Supreme Court, or the President, or the similar officials in other countries. They can enforce their decisions with retaliatory trade sanctions, like putting punitive tariffs on a country's exports, or withdrawing international property rights, like patent protections, from the country's companies. And in the case of the investment tribunals, they can levy unlimited money damages, sometimes running into the billions of dollars that can break a public budget, and that's paid to rich investors and rich multinational corporations in compensation for having to obey sensible regulations, particularly in the area of environment and public health.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, these are under the guise of trade. The corporations who have helped negotiate these agreements are really using them as a means to strip down any accountability, any regulatory limitations on their business activities, even when, you know, what is being sought to regulate is in fact something that would be harmful to the health of people, food, the environment, or whatever it is. You know, and so therefore it would be a good idea for people who want to live, want their grandchildren to live, to have some protections in place. But this would limit the corporate profits to some slight degree, and therefore it's anathema. And so these so-called trade agreements are really vehicles for imposing that will, you know, and sort of steamrolling past that. And, of course, when we were first talking about this, Bill, the idea that that kind of radical regulatory takedown could occur was, you know, kind of, it was almost like unreal to people. They couldn't believe that something like that would happen. It was so unprecedented. There was a sense of security provided by the past history of regulation, you know, that nobody would have the daring to strip them down in this way. And so when we first began sharing and discussing the implications of these agreements, I know a lot of people just simply couldn't believe that that could happen. Of course, in today's climate, it's far more believable because it's kind of like the boxing gloves have been taken off and we're seeing what the intentions are in terms of a radical shift and a radical stripping down of government protections of all sorts. And so now it doesn't seem an impossible surprise that could never, ever happen, and you know, would be a paranoid or conspiracy idea to even think that it could. Now we're actually seeing that played out regularly. So, you know, right now with the, you know, in the aftermath, it's been 10 months or 8 or 9 months since the defeat of the TPP, and that's not going forward. What is the Trump administration pushing forward at this time, and then how is that comparing in terms of what they are seeking to do?
Sure.
To the past?
The Trump administration is moving to renegotiate a number of existing U.S. Trade agreements, and they're starting out with the most important one of all, and that's the North American Free Trade Agreement between Mexico, the United States, and Canada. And when he was running for president, Trump demonized NAFTA, demonized the Trans-Pacific Partnership and other trade deals, and promised to protect the American people. And that was a big factor in his victory, especially in some of the Rust Belt states like Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, Indiana, and so forth. So he was pretty shrewd in figuring out, an issue that would, the American people would respond to. But it turns out he was playing game of bait and switch, because even though he had, called the NAFTA in his campaign as the worst trade deal ever, it's now very clear that, he's modified his message and he's really not behaving as if it was the worst deal ever. In fact, he's going back in to renegotiate it and to provide even more giveaways to wealthy investors and gigantic multinational corporations. So, he's a very effective con man. Sold a bill of goods, and you got something else.
Mm-hmm. I mean, just as an aside, before we go into further detail about what these giveaways are and what they will affect, do you think that his, the groups that voted for him and that, were pleased about his rejection of these deals are following the news to the extent that they would be aware of this shift and this bait and switch that you discussed, or kind of are they, not so apt to follow all of this in a non-presidential election year and therefore, still support him, not fully aware of what's going on now? I realize it's not your area specifically, but, do you have any sense of that?
I know exactly what's going on. Donald Trump is still lying to the American people. And in many respects, his rhetoric hasn't changed. And he may leave the impression on, 24-hour cable news where things are, he don't do exactly a deep dive into public policy, that he's pursuing what he promised to do. But I read the legal texts of what he's proposing. And so if you get down into the weeds and you understand what these technical legal terms mean, you understand that he's lying, that he's looking out for Goldman Sachs and Merrill Lynch and the big investment banks and the wealthy individuals who many of whom supported his campaign and with whom he hobnobs at his Florida golf resort. So we've had dissembling presidents and politicians for a long time, but this guy takes the cake. It's almost breathtaking.
So what is the difference between what he says he's doing, and when you dig down into the weeds, what is it that you find?
Well, He says he wants to, you know, protect the American people by, you know, from these awful international institutions. You know, he plays the patriotism, nationalism card, and so forth. But if you read his legal negotiating objectives, what he is going to do is further empower these international tribunals that can levy unlimited money damages against a public budget or apply retaliatory trade sanctions that could damage a country's economy unless they roll back environmental, climate, and other public interest regulations.
So the international tribunals are basically there because instead of citizens being able to sue, and a lot of people, one of the, you know, huge confusing things for a lot of people when we were in the process of first educating people to these agreements, one of the things that confused people, quite often people would say to me, after reading an article or hearing one of these radio shows or discussing it with me in person at some venue, they would say, oh, well, that could never happen, that, you know, these, regulations would be stripped down and then, you know, there would be environmental harm because we could sue. But in fact, the novel thing about these agreements is that they permit companies to sue governments and therefore us, the citizens who pay taxes to those governments, or even, you know, municipalities. It's like suddenly the shoe is on to the other foot, where the popular assumption is that we could always sue, whereas the new reality as these deals expand in strength is that we would be the ones on the receiving end of the suit if we attempt to limit the contamination, the other things that are happening. If we attempt to do anything about it, we would, you know, it's we the public who would be subject to a lawsuit. Can you give some, you know, an example of a case where that has happened and that, you know, where we're having kind of an expanded, like, you know, the trade agreements or the TPP is written was looking pretty bad. Is the new version of NAFTA going to be actually worse than what we were fighting before?
Well, the Trump administration has made it clear that they are going to take the most pro-corporate, the most undemocratic provisions of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement and put them in NAFTA, in the rewrite. And so, you know, the TPP, you know, it was even more insidious than NAFTA because the corporate lawyers figured out more clever ways to go after and undercut the public interest. So Wilbur Ross, who's Trump's commerce secretary, actually blurted out the truth, intentionally or not, when he said that they fully intended to import the language on the Trans-Pacific Partnership into the North American Free Trade Agreement, you know, as it applies to issues of regulation and environmental regulation in particular.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the net effect of doing that is that there's more global gas development, there's more global oil development, there's more export and import, and there's more pipelines, and therefore there is more fossil fuel excavation and transport that contributes to the acceleration of climate change. Is that a fair summary of the, you know, kind of overall concerns? I know contamination is also a concern.
Oh, yeah. It's really across the board. I mean, you're talking of, I mean, climate, of course, really, you know, and efforts by to enforce the Paris Climate Accord and to save the planet from melting down. You know, all these would be violations. Of course, remember, Trump is the one who scandalized the whole world by pulling the United States out of the Paris Climate Accord, and he's bringing that same war on the planet attitude to negotiating these trade agreements. And there are separate chapters in the North American Free Trade Agreement where they'll be putting in new language that would roll back, for example, effective regulation of dangerous chemicals, the kind that are associated with breast cancer or autism or infertility and other things. And there's language in these agreements, is going to be put into these agreements that will restrict our capacity to regulate neonic pesticides, which, as you know, are killing the bees, and the bees pollinate our food. And these dangerous pesticides threaten to not only wipe out one of the most important animal species, but present an existential threat to mankind, because we depend on the bees to pollinate in order to get our food. And I can go down the list of product labeling measures, such as dolphin-safe tuna labeling and GMO labeling can be attacked. And there are also ones related to general food safety, in the sense that they would apply cost-benefit analysis with absolutely unreasonable requirements of scientific certainty before you could engage in very basic food and product safety regulations. So there's a long list, but those are some of the prominent examples of the very serious threat that we face.
So, again, in the same way that it used to be that the people could sue, it also, you know, was always a goal, and in some parts of the world enacted better than in others, including our own, but it was always a goal to think ahead and study the harmful potential impacts of certain chemicals or certain practices, so that we're not doing harm unknowingly because we haven't studied it, and then we're blindsided by the negative impacts. Instead, the call was always to increase our foresightedness and really study and assess and evaluate, what might be the effects of using certain products or doing certain activities or processes, you know. And here, again, that's being reversed. The bar is so high that not only is it not being studied at the outset so that we can not do something that's going to be proving harmful, but even if it is doing harm, the onus of proof, from what you're describing, sounds like it's placed on the people to prove that it's harmful rather than on the companies to prove that their activities are safe.
Or even if it's known to be, but even if it's known to be unsafe, but they've already made an investment, they can demand that the taxpayers pay them for their investment plus interest and expected future profits. Just to give one example of a project that wasn't finished, and that's the Keystone XL pipeline, or hasn't been finished yet. During the Obama administration, you may recall that Friends of the Earth and people like you and people in your listening audience, really took a stand against this tar sands oil pipeline from Canada to the Gulf Coast that would have really ramped up global warming. And a gigantic movement was established, and eventually it put enough pressure on Barack Obama to cancel the deal. Well, what happened immediately after that? The company that was building the Keystone XL pipeline, TransCanada, Canadian corporation, sued under NAFTA and demanded $15 billion in compensation from U.S. taxpayers because Obama made a sensible decision in terms of environmental policy. Of course, this was $15 billion that they hadn't earned, but it was their expected future earnings that they wanted to get out of the pocket of every one of us U.S. taxpayers. And I think that's a good example of how dangerous that is, because the decision of a Democratic government responding to widespread public opinion did the right thing by canceling this dangerous pipeline in order to prevent the planet from being cooked. And this giant corporation had a right to demand $15 billion in compensation. Now, Trump, of course, he wants to cook the planet in wartime. He's he's moving forward to greatly expand the production and burning of fossil fuels. And of course, one of his first decisions was to reverse Obama's decision and go ahead with the KXL pipeline. So they did withdraw their $15 billion suit in response to that. But this illustrates the danger that we face, that you can literally be impoverished for responding to the will of the people.
Yes, and also it establishes the right to corporate profits as the preeminent right to be assured. In other words, the right to healthy water, food, and air, that's not a right. You no longer have that right. But the companies have the right to their proper, profits as a sort of prime right, and anything that interferes with that means that we have to compensate them. I mean, it's kind of so backward that it boggles the mind that this could be happening. But I think at this point, people have seen enough through his appointments and elsewhere many people do, to really understand this destructive trend. Now, what are the steps, to ratify and, enact these changes into NAFTA? Like, what are the next steps? We know the process, or, people who were involved and can listen to the past Connect the Dots. So, we were on a process with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, but NAFTA, as an already existing agreement that's being revised, what is the process for making these changes? That, who has to decide in what sequence? Where is there an opportunity for public participation, an intervention or comment? What is the process now for NAFTA?
Okay, well, the official negotiating objectives of Donald Trump, pursuant to legal requirement, were published in late July. They were vague, but they gave us, put a chill down my back, because we could see exactly which way they were going. And then we had the first round of negotiations between Mexico, Canada, and the United States not quite a week ago. And we're going to have the second round starting September 1st over the Labor Day weekend. They are on a accelerated schedule to renegotiate this deal, and they want to get it completed by the end of the year, even though this means that they may be holding 4- and 5-day negotiating sessions every 2 or 3 weeks for the remainder of the year. Now, the good thing about that is that we don't have to maintain the focus of the public for 6, 7, or 8 years as we did with the TPP. That was a long battle. Now, this is going to go up or down very quickly, and your listeners and the public in general can really make an impact, by writing their members of Congress, talking to their friends, their families, communicating to the press The imminent threat that's presented by this NAFTA renegotiation. And I'm very optimistic that we're going to be able to trump, if you will.
Well, and we also have on our side greater awareness. More people are more activated. So, you know, all of that is hopeful. Which house or both houses of Congress, who will be voting on this?
Well,
you know,
nobody will be voting on it if they fail mm-hmm. to cut a deal. And the question is whether Canada and Mexico will bow down and accept Trump's demands. And I think that every sign that Canada and Mexico, you know, do not want to cooperate fully. Remember that Mexico has been the subject of vicious racist attacks by Donald Trump. You know, he's demanded, you know, a wall be put up on the border to keep Mexicans out, and that Mexico should pay for it. And he's engaged in routine slurs against Mexican people. And so, you know, the Mexicans, we have a quite conservative government in there right now that's very close to the corporations. But, you know, they're paying attention to public opinion in Mexico, and they're going to have a presidential election in less than a year. And the progressive candidate, Obrador, could very well win if the current government of Peña Nieto, you know, gives away the store and disgraces the national pride of Mexico in these negotiations with Trump. In the same way, the Canadians are, you know, they're not rolling over. So we'll see whether they can get a deal or not. If it does,
so
if we do get a deal, then it goes to Congress and for an up or down vote to either accept or reject. But we may never get there.
And I guess the organizing goal is to prevent it from getting there.
And that's exactly right.
So,
we need to get public awareness out, and we've got to educate the American people about Trump's lies, because there are a lot of people, you know, who don't stay up at night reading the Federal Register and trade documents, and they hear what Trump says. And he's lying. He is not protecting the average worker, the average family from his international trade agreements. He's making them worse and presenting an even greater threat than financial burden on ordinary working families. So, you know, that's tough. I mean, we've had dissembling politicians and, you know, shifty presidents in the past, but we've never had one who was a blatant liar and a con man of almost staggering proportions. It's disorienting.
Yes, to say the least. Where are the Democratic Party politicians on this? The Trans-Pacific Partnership at that time. It was, you know, that round of the trade agreements was actually being, you know, pushed and furthered by a Democratic president and, you know, working in concert with both Republican and more conservative Democratic members of Senate and Congress. You know, we were down to a game of counting numbers, you know, as to you know, where each congressional representative stood, you know, and which, and, you know, where the Senate stood on these issues as we went through various stages of the progress of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Has there been, you know, hopefully it won't even get to them, but, you know, they still can play an important role in either sounding the alarm or reassuring and pacifying people about this. Has there been any shift in the champions ranks, or, you know, those who are slightly on the sun since the last time. Like, for example, now, given, you know, Trump in office as president, you know, every time Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon speaks up, everyone is enthusiastic that someone, you know, Democratic senator is talking up to, you know, this wrongheaded leadership. At the same time, looking back to this earlier fight, he was a champion of these trade agreements.
Yep.
So,
right.
You know, I pick him out as one example because I'm always hearing what a good guy he is, and I know what a terrible role he played in that. But, you know, have you seen any shift, you know, in the elected officials, you know, coming around to this round?
I think it's breaking down more or less as it did before, you know, and they did
mm-hmm.
not have the votes for the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And in the House of Representatives, the Democratic Party opposition was overwhelming. There were only
mm-hmm.
about 25 or so who were supporting the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So the Democratic caucus across the board was defying and challenging a very popular Democratic president on the TPP. If anything,
mm-hmm.
You will see, you know, since Trump doesn't have any fans at all in the Democratic caucus whatsoever, you know, it'll be even more difficult for Trump to sell this to Democrats than it was for Obama. Beyond that, there are a fair number of Republicans who oppose the TPP on national sovereignty grounds. And I guess the big question is, since these are often fairly conservative, sometimes even right-wing members of Congress, whether their loyalty to Trump, if they have any, will override their concerns about the intrusion on constitutional principles. I mean, the famous statement by the former Secretary General of the World Trade Organization, Renato Ruggiero, a number of years ago, saying that the World Trade Organization, just like the NAFTA governance system, created a constitution for the world economy. I mean,
mm-hmm.
this really is a world government that is run by and for multinational corporations and wealthy financiers. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, principal conservatives are going to have some problems with that because, you know, a lot of them are populist conservatives and they are distrustful of faraway institutions, especially
mm-hmm.
if they're located in foreign countries or on the East Coast.
Mm-hmm.
And so
mm-hmm.
you get that sort of conservative populist opposition to trade agreements,
mm-hmm.
I think that, and furthermore, I think a lot of the establishment country club Republicans are not real fond of Donald Trump, although they're frightened of him and intimidated by him. And so I don't think if it goes to Congress that it's going to be easy sailing. And I would say our chances of defeating it there, if necessary, are better than 50-50.
That's great. That's really good news. So, you know, how, I mean, people need to keep informed as this progresses. I guess we need to also, for those of us who have Canadian friends and allies and family, as I know I do, you know, to also make sure that they're informed and they are, you know, leaning on the Canadian government. What is Justin Trudeau? What is his position on this?
Well, he's at the negotiating table. I mean, in
yep.
effect, Trump has essentially put a pistol to his head and said, "You will negotiate." But it's not clear that he he's going to give away the store. I mean, Canada has actually profited considerably from NAFTA, unlike the United States and Mexico. But it's a proud country, and they don't like being pushed around, and they defend their own sovereignty. So Trump will only be able to push Justin Trudeau so far.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's even more important to communicate to our friends and family, if we have any, in Mexico, because there's literally a mass movement arising among the workers and the peasants and the intellectuals in Mexico to resist and defy Trump, particularly on this NAFTA renegotiation, and to be prepared to kill the whole deal rather than accede to the demands of a man who's clearly a racist and anti-Mexican bigot.
Mm-hmm. It certainly isn't, a demonstration of skill in negotiation to insult and target people with inaccurate racist comments, to build a wall to separate our country unnecessarily from them, and then, to go to the table and endeavor to negotiate with them. Certainly that isn't anything approaching what we would dreaming. It's almost foreign, so tragic, it would be humorous. It's nothing approaching any form of traditional diplomacy or any kind of savvy or emotional intelligence of any kind, actually. Beyond even that, the NAFTA in its original iteration was not, a great friend to Mexico, and had, a number of harmful effects on the Mexican people. I mean, what were some of those?
Well, it was very profitable for the rich upper class in Mexico. They've made a lot of money out of NAFTA. I think of Carlos Slim, for example, who is one of the richest men in the world. I mean, he's, not far behind Bill Gates. And he's mm-hmm. fabulously rich, and he got fabulously richer because he was able to, in effect, collect monopoly rents and charge a lot more for his goods and services and so forth. But the vast majority of Mexicans were badly hurt by NAFTA. In particular, there was a flood of subsidized American grain, especially corn, but other agricultural grains into Mexico. The result was that literally millions of small peasant farmers, corn farmers, sustainable farmers, were driven mm-hmm. out of business. They literally couldn't feed their family. And that's why millions of Mexicans went on that day. To feed their starving children, the parents had to sneak across the Rio Grande and take whatever kind of job they could find on the sly in the United States to simply survive. So when Trump and others complain about the tidal wave of Mexican immigration into the United States, you have to understand that NAFTA was in many respects the root cause of this, because you had a large millions and millions of small, sustainable peasant farmers across Mexico who lost their livelihood as a result of NAFTA, and they literally had to flee north. So, this agreement's done great harm to the planet, but also to people, and the last thing we need is to see that damage magnified by Donald Trump.
And lastly, the very, one of the preeminent campaign issues that he articulated in his appeal to bigotry and racism was based on people's reaction to a social condition, and a business mode of activity that he was attacked by. So this is like the classic theme of, it's both blaming the victim, but it's also, you build a wall to deal with something that your allegiances to corporate entities has created, and now you're perpetuating it. So, is that, do you think,
too complex and sort of follow a connection for both of the supporters to grasp, would you think that can be made? Because it's certainly deeply ironic for anyone who can see that connection.
Yeah, well, I think the average American family is suspicious about the candor and truthfulness of politicians.
Mm-hmm.
But Donald Trump is a very skillful liar. And like fascists and quasi-fascists in the past, in some ways you can get away with a big outrageous lie quicker than you can with, a little bit of dissembling, so to speak. And the other thing is that, there are certain principles that people like Goebbels developed, and that is, no matter how outrageous the lie is, you keep repeating it. It's like an advertising slogan. The slogan is repeated over and over again until it begins to seep into one's subconscious. And this kind of manipulation and inducement of mass hysteria, is the reason for the rise of fascism. And consciously or unconsciously, Donald Trump has the same sort of communication approach that we saw in Germany and other fascist countries in the 1930s. And the last thing we need is a return to that mentality.
Yeah. No kidding. That kind of brings us to the more, kind of general picture that we have right now under this new administration in terms of, a higher level of threat and government, social breakdown, government abdication of proper role, corporate overrule. These are just, just a short list of what's being furthered by this administration. What do you see again, this is not your specific area, but you're a contemplative person, you're right in the very key and critical issue. So, I have to ask, what is your view of how we're doing on the pushback, resistance, consciousness raising, and gathering of more citizenry ready and willing to get involved?
I can tell you about Friends of the Earth. Our membership has been outraged. They've been making phone calls, writing letters, organizing community meetings. Our membership has shot up because people know Friends of the Earth is a cutting edge and aggressive opponent of Donald Trump. And I see an uprising of ordinary Americans. Working people who usually don't have time to, raising a family and taking care of demanding job to get involved in public affairs or civic matters, except on a limited basis. But you've seen people who, take time off of work and not get paid in order to come to Washington to express their outrage. And they're writing Congress. They're talking to their friends and neighbors. They're communicating to the press outlets. I mean, the response by the professional politicians in Washington D.C. has been a little disappointing. They just don't know what to make of Donald Trump, and they're a bit intimidated. But I'm very hopeful because the American people are rising up and determined to reclaim their democracy and protect the planet and get the republic sailing on a steady and true course.
Well, that is very hopeful. We also want to send listeners to this program to Friends of the Earth, FOE.org, where you can sign up for more information about events, actions, and just plain background information on this and other issues. So, I want to say that. You can also support the organization through your donations. This is a time when, in many ways people can step up, and, it's getting to the point where I say this in almost every program. If you can go to a march, go to a march. If you can pressure your politicians, do that. If you can let other people know through social media or conversation, educate others, by all means do that. Stay educated yourself. If you're able to make a donation, make a donation, because both, longstanding nonprofits of integrity, and not all are of integrity, sad to say, but Friends of the Earth certainly is, as well as journalistic outlets, can definitely benefit from our support at this time. In terms of media outlets, I want to kind of mention two, one of which I write for and the other which I don't write for, but I'm a fan of, that are always good to support. Common Dreams does terrific ongoing coverage. They're just terrific. And Truth Out, also, that's a media outlet that I contribute to, as well as Truthdig. There are many others. The Intercept. We need the information, and we need the organizations that are on top of the game. Popular Resistance also does terrific reporting and organizing on the trade agreements. I'm sure I've left a few out. Do you have any others that we could toss in there, Bill?
Yep, there's a very broad resistance, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, the American Civil Liberties Union has been on the forefront, mm-hmm. because Trump is a threat to constitutional government and the Bill of Rights and so forth. That's very obvious. But I think that his major target is the environment. Remember, as I said before, this is a guy who tore up U.S. participation in the Paris Climate Accord, scandalized the world. The whole world was aghast at this. This is the man who wants to super ramp up production and burning of fossil fuels. This is the guy who wants to roll back the regulations that protect clean air and clean water and protect us from dangerous chemicals and unsafe food. There is a rising up in opposition to that. If your listeners want to get involved, check out our website, www.foe.org. Or if they want to drop an email to me, I'd be happy to respond and suggest ways they can be engaged. And my email address is wwaren@foe.org. My name's spelled a little unusual. It's only one R rather than two.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So be in touch with me, listeners, if you want to.
That's great. That's great. Thanks, Bill. It's terrific. Of course, everyone can follow me on my Facebook page, Allison Rose Levy, and Connecting the Dots for Health, my public page, to receive show announcements. And if you like this program, please do share it with people on social media, because, we're catching the wave again, with the next ramp up, it's been a while since, we've been working on this front, but now it's back. So this is very timely. And if you want to familiarize yourselves in greater detail about, what the investment trade courts are about, what they've done in the past, what the specific concerns about toxic chemical regulation and environmental, slam downs, you can also listen to past shows in the Connect the Dots archive, which is at Podbean, Podbean, connectthedots.com. And, all past shows with Bill Warren and other guests on this issue are there. And so this is like the timely moment. Pass this along to people that in Canada, in Mexico, relatives, friends, You know, it's funny, I'll just share a short story with you, Bill. The very first event that I think I attended was about, which was in, you know, about the TPP, was in Queens, New York, where, and it was organized by, you know, Latino American organizers and labor people in Queens, because the aftermath of NAFTA for, you know, Mexican farmers and workers was so adverse, and a lot of the people had to abandon their land and emigrated to, you know, the U.S. and wound up in New York. And so they were really educating us about, you know, what was going on with these, you know, with NAFTA as we all looked the other way, what was going on in Mexico. And at the same meeting, the, you know, the renowned global economist Joseph Stiglitz spoke, and he told the audience, you know, who was wondering, because at the time people were extremely puzzled at why a popular and, you know, Democratic president like President Obama would be espousing the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Joseph Stiglitz also reminded the audience about, you know, the campaign funding that had come from Wall Street to President Obama, as well as the, you know, former trade representative from that administration, who had also come to the White House from Wall Street to kind of honcho and lead the charge on these deals. And, you know, it was really interesting because at the time, people were like, the people that I was sitting in a group with, I spoke to some of them later, and no one could remember Stiglitz's statement because it was so shocking and unbelievable to them, mm-hmm. that there could be any kind of Wall Street connection with what a well-liked president like President Obama would do. You know, one thing we can say now is, and, you know, I think, and it took quite a lot, I think it was a big obstacle to educating on the first round of these deals because people couldn't believe, you know, that such a thing could be going on. Now, with this president, it's obviously flagrantly obvious to everyone that, you know, that he is acting on the behalf of Wall Street and these mm-hmm. companies. It's not
right.
like
it's
a secret. So in a way, even though we wish it wasn't happening, we can do more to assure that it doesn't happen because more people see it. So, again, ending on the hopeful note, I want to thank you for being with us today, again, on Connect the Dots, Bill Warren of Friends of the Earth. Thank you for the terrific work you're doing and, you know, have been doing and continue to do over many, many years. And, you know, keep us informed. We'll stay informed and sharing with listeners and bring you back again as this progresses. And thank you for joining me on today's Connect the Dots.
Thank you so much, Allison. You're a great journalist, and I so much enjoy talking with you.
Yeah, we always have a great time talking about these horrible things that are happening.
Yeah, we sure do.
You know, I'll tell you, the thing, people say activists are angry, but it's really the community of caring people that is so uplifting. None of us could do it alone, and it's in community together with the like-minded that we really get the courage and the sustainability of our resistance. So join in, everybody. That's, you know, where the water's fine. That's where the action is. All right. Thank you, listeners, for being with us on today's Connect the Dots. Come back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Chin up and keep marching forward.
Well,